You let it sound my only be lafanecha Adonai Tzoriva Goali. May the words of my mouth and thoughts of my heart be acceptable before you, O God, my rock and my redeemer. Shalom all and welcome. I'm your host, Ariel Bar Tzedok. You find me online at koshertorah.com. I've titled this course, An Orthodox Rabbi Reads the Christian Bible. My purpose and intent in teaching this course is simple. I want to be able to explain why Torah Judaism and Torah faithful Jews do not and will not accept or embrace the teachings of the Christian religion. I have no intentions or desire in this course to attack the religion of Christianity. I am not here to challenge or critique those who embrace the Christian faith. I am not here to talk about Christianity at all. Even though due to the nature of this material, I'm sure that I will not be able to avoid the topic entirely. Nevertheless, I'm here to look at the Christian Bible from an entirely Torah point of view. I begin with certain premises. I do not deny the existence of an historical Yeshu, be he called Yeshua or what. For Torah faithful Jews, Yeshu was not, is not, and can never be the Messiah of Israel. For Torah faithful Jews, Yeshu was not, is not, and can never be God, or even a son of God, any more than any other human being of flesh and blood. For the record, the historical Yeshu was born, lived as, and died as a Jew. He and his original followers were all Jews, who, like him, were born, lived as, and died as Jews. Absolutely none of them were Christians in any sense of the word. We Torah faithful Jews follow the same religion that Yeshu himself practiced. We pray to the same Heavenly Father. We live by the same Torah, mitzvot, and ma'asim tovim. Yeshu was not a Christian, neither are we. Yeshu's original followers were all Torah-observant Jews, as was he. As Jews educated in Torah, drenched in its teachings, and from what can be seen, knowing no other spiritual path, I must logically conclude that all the original writings of Yeshu's original followers were all Jewish writings, and therefore well within my domain as a Torah-observant rabbi to read them and understand them as would one rabbi to another. I therefore begin with the position that anything found in the Christian Bible or attributed to any of its Jewish authors that does not agree with Torah Judaism must not have been written by such an author and is therefore subject to suspicion and must be critically analyzed. And that is what I am here to do. Like many Torah sages before me, I do not accept Talmudic Midrash about Yeshu at face value. Those teachings were meant to be polemic, not historical, and therefore they will not be part of our discussions. Now, I've been led to perform this work because of my experiences in my personal life. As a teenager, I was victimized by a terrible evangelical group in my hometown on Long Island. This group was led by an evil, lying, deceitful individual who turned out to also be a pedophile. I am thankful that I was able to escape being victimized in that way. Nevertheless, this individual sought to clandestinely place his minions in Orthodox yeshivot in Israel to get them to learn about Judaism with the attempt to make it easier for them to persuade Jews to convert and join their fold. I fought long and hard against this group, and I'm proud of my contributions in thwarting their efforts. It was through them and because of them that I became exposed to Christianity, and have therefore devoted the last 40 years of my life to study and investigation to discover whatever of the truth that is still out there to be discovered. And now, after 40 years, I feel confident and ready to share my insights and discoveries with you. And so again, I reiterate, I am not here to attack our God-fearing, Bible-believing Christian neighbors. I hold them in the highest esteem and respect. I'm here to explain to you, to them, and to all willing to listen, what we Torah faithful Jews see when we read the Christian Bible, and why we see what we do. And now, let us proceed with tonight's lesson. Alrighty. This is the 18th lesson in this series, if I'm not mistaken. We are going to cover tonight the 25th chapter of the book of Matthew, and if we can, we will go beyond that in the chapter 26 as well. A couple of points that I want to emphasize right here before we go on. And that, of course, like we've shared in the previous classes, is the overwhelming Jewish nature of many of the teachings herein. a point that I've made in our previous classes, while reviewing the specific teachings of Yeshu himself personally, we have seen that without a doubt almost all of his teachings are echoes of the classical Pharisaic Talmudic teachings of his day. In other words, there really isn't that many shocking or revelatory insights that Yeshu says that we don't find originally earlier in the Talmud, in Talmudic literature, in Talmudic thought. Whether or not it had been written in that day or not, the ideas were still prevalent. What I'm trying to say should be clear, and that's this. The majority of that which Christians hold dear about the teachings of their Yeshu are the same things that Jews hold dear about the teachings of our Judaism. Essentially, what most Christians do not know is that a lot of what they believe and hold dear are Jewish teachings. And of course, that's exactly what this course is all about. As an Orthodox rabbi reading this material, my point and purpose again is to help our Christian neighbors know and understand that a lot of what they do believe and rightly embrace, so do we. And indeed, we've embraced these teachings before they did. Now, this is not a competition, but it should be an ability, a door, through which we can all walk, building bridges, to see that which we truly have in common with one another. Now, the historical Yeshu himself, we clearly have divergent understandings of, and a point that I've made very clear throughout this entire series, a point that's echoed by many Christian theologians, like S.G.F. Brandon, amongst others, is that Yeshu himself clearly was of the zealot camp, clearly was preparing a military, popular insurrection uprising against the Roman government in his day and lifetime. And the entire concept of a crucifixion, resurrection, and second coming, we don't find any references of that at all in Yeshu's teachings himself. That comes all later. That's all Christianity. Yeshu clearly spoke in numerous places about the imminent coming of what we learn from Malachi is called the great day of the Lord. Yeshu was trying to instigate, Yeshu was trying to start the great civil war, and historically it was in the 60s, all right, that's in the 60s of the first century, when the Birionim, who were the zealots, the Sicarii, the followers of Yeshu, did succeed in capturing Jerusalem, causing the great siege, which led to the destruction of the city. So, we see the echoes of Yeshu and his teachings. We see it in history. We see it in Christian scholarship. We see it in our Judaism. We're not here to argue or debate the issue of the personage of Yeshu, but like this course is entitled, to go and to look, to see what the words are and to understand of what they say. Chapter 25 has what I will call very Jewish teachings about the coming of the Messiah. This is a chapter of stories, parables as they're called in Christianity, or what we would call in Judaism, midrash, mashalim, which are examples, stories. Chapter 25 speaks of a parable of 10 virgins, and it goes like this. Then shall the kingdom of heaven be likened unto 10 virgins who took their lamps and went forth to meet the bridegroom. Now remember, the term kingdom of heaven, Malchut Shemaim, a term very well known in Judaism, is referred to, or means, the rule of God upon the earth. God in heaven is God in heaven. That's not our human concern. We're concerned with the rule of God on earth. That's called the kingdom of heaven. Kingdom of heaven upon the earth. How does that come about? Well, human beings created. The first one who started that was King David, followed by Solomon. And, of course, the prophecy is the descendant of David and Solomon is going to come and reestablish the monarchy. A physical government in the physical land of Israel, nothing to do with the world to come or heaven or anything of the kind. This, and this alone, is called the kingdom of heaven. So when Yeshua is now going to tell us about the kingdom of heaven, he's obviously, in the Jewish context, making a reference to the coming of the political movement and the success of the political movement, the reestablishment of the Davidic monarchy of which we speak. Nothing to do with heaven, the afterlife, all politics. This kingdom of heaven is like 10 virgins who took their lamps to wait for the bridegroom. In other words, when you went to a wedding, right, the chatan and the kala, the bride and the groom, they come. So obviously, why is he referring to the bridegroom? What happened to the bride? Where is she? Well, Yeshua doesn't need to be so detailed in using his example. So he's referring to the bridegroom as an example as to the coming of Mashiach. Okay? I think that's clear from the text. There's nothing controversial about that. So in that light, let's continue to read it. 5 of the girls were wise and 5 were foolish. Those that were foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them. Alright? But the wise took oil in their vessels with their lamps. What is oil and what is the lamp? Well, let's analyze the symbol. What do you need a lamp for? So you can see in the dark. What do you need oil for? Well, gee whiz, isn't that the way they didn't make the lamp work? If this example was being given today, you would say that you brought your batteries and your flashlight. Same thing. What is this a symbol for? Well, it's interesting. Yeshua is reflecting here a teaching in the first century of this common era, which was actually codified by Maimonides over 1,000 years later. For those of you who don't already know, one of the 13 principles of Judaism is, number 12 exactly, I believe in perfect faith in the coming of the Messiah. Now here's the point. And although he may tarry, I wait daily for his coming. In other words, when is Mashiach coming? We've been asking that question for a long time. Well, guess what? In Yeshua's day, they were asking the same question in the same way as we do today. And the attitude then, like now, is that Mashiach will come instantly, with a surprise. This is a traditional, classical Jewish teaching. It's actually recorded in the Talmud, tractate Sanhedrin, page 97a, where the sages say, 3 things come when the mind is otherwise occupied. A found garment, a scorpion, and Mashiach. In other words, when you least expect it, there he is. Here's Mashiach now. Boom! In our course on the academic review of post-Talmudic Jewish Messianism, in which we have taught many of the legends, the teachings, and the Midrashim about the coming of Mashiach, one thread which seems to run through many of the narratives was that Mashiach ben David comes out of nowhere as a surprise. So this attitude, this idea of the sudden revelation of the Messianic King, which, mind you, is not necessarily the view as espoused by Maimonides himself, still seems to be the underlying echo of what Yeshua was referring to about this bridegroom and these virgins waiting for him. Essentially, he says you have two types of people. Those who prepare and those who don't. Well, again, what does it mean to prepare for the sudden coming of the Messiah, the Mashiach? Well, let's put it into a context. What does it mean when Mashiach comes? Let's say, for example, right now, we turn on the news, radio, TV, internet, whatever, and flash, front page story on every news around the world. There's a great light over the skies of Jerusalem. There's this big army coming out of the sky. This big guy on a white horse, or donkey, depending on your point of view, comes and lands on the Temple Mount and speaks in a big loud voice, which everybody can hear, "I am Mashiach, I am here." Okay? Surprise, surprise, Mashiach has come. Great, cool, groovy. What now? What next? Mashiach is here. Okay. Should I expect to see angels flying over my house ready to rapture me and move me to Jerusalem? What about my family? What about my house? What about my mortgage? What about my bills? My goodness, what about my pets? My animals, right? Who's gonna milk the cows? I mean, I got realistic circumstances I got to consider here. All right? I'm at work. I'm at the job. People need me. And all of a sudden, that is, it'd be very irresponsible if all of a sudden, poof, I disappear. It reminds me of the mythology that is told in many Protestant Christian circles today about the rapture, where in which they believe that all of a sudden people are going to like be beamed out, kind of like in Star Trek, and they disappear. So pilots who are flying planes, all of a sudden the planes are going to crash, cars are going to miss their drivers, they're going to crash, everything's going to explode and blow up because all the faithful Christians disappear. Really? Well, of course, in fantasy and mythology, that's a popular image. But I think that's so grossly irresponsible, I can never imagine God doing that. Or I can hardly imagine people believing that, but they do. But Mashiach comes suddenly. And then what? So what? What is the nature of this suddenness? I'm not being picked up and teleported to Israel. If Mashiach wants me to move to Israel, then I am sure he will make whatever means are appropriate and necessary to get me over there in whatever ways and forms that he as a king is going to establish. And I'll bet you it's not going to happen in an instant. It might take days, weeks, maybe even months. Who knows? So what's the rush? What's the hurry? What's the importance of being immediately and always ready? Even like Maimonides said 1,000 years after this. I don't get it. Or do I? Well, let's put this into the context of the times. All right? Remember this, even in those days where in which a supernatural Mashiach was expected, in the context of the supernatural Mashiach, what was he supposed to do? He was going to come with powers and abilities far above that of mortal man. He was going to be faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, and leap tall buildings in a single bound without having to wear a red, white, and blue uniform with a big S on his chest either. But that was Mashiach. He's Superman. And when he comes, oh boy, things are going to happen. And they're going to happen right away because he's going to introduce miracles and miraculous events. So unlike that which we would expect today. So unlike what Maimonides writes. And yet we do wait imminently. Even though waiting for what? I'm not so sure. But in those days, this super Messiah, the supernatural being, was going to demand the people at the moment, on the spot, to rise up in active political insurrection against Rome. In other words, he would give the signal and he would expect his minions to capture the city of Jerusalem, burn all of its supplies, force the people into war, act impetuously, impulsively, immediately. That was the expectation of the day. And this is the underlying concept to this parable of why he's speaking about wise and foolish virgins carrying their lamps, symbolic of being prepared, with oil being ready at the moment. So it says, while the bridegroom tarried, just like Mashiach tarries, they all slumbered and slept. In other words, they were all falling short of their loyalty to House David, and therefore not being ready for the messianic moment. This was exactly Yeshu's historical dilemma in his day. He was trying to arouse the populace to follow him in an insurrection. I don't know about you. Are you inclined to follow people into armed insurrection and revolution against the government? Sorry, I'm not. And a Mashiach came to my door today and says, you know, Rabbi Ariel, I want you to join me in an armed insurrection against the state of Israel or anything else. I said, you know something, Mr. Mashiach, King Mashiach, if you're really the Mashiach, you go do this with your army of angels supernaturally. I'm really not going to get involved. I'm not going to be involved in insurrective politics. I'm not a traitor, treason. I'm not into terrorism of any kind. You could do this supernaturally, and then I'll be more than happy to join your kingdom when it comes. Yeshu probably would have been really angry with me if I gave him an answer like that. But I'm sure he got that answer all too many. And as such, that is his reference here to the foolish virgins. I guess he would have called me a foolish virgin. What can I say? So at midnight, in the darkest of night, cry is made, behold, the bridegroom cometh! Go out and meet him! Mashiach is here! Let's go, rise up! Then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps. The foolish said unto the wise, give us of your oil, for our lamps have gone out. In other words, those who aren't ready for Mashiach to come, turn to others and say, help us be ready like you are. And I suspect something. This is what I suspect. I don't have the original Aramaic here. I don't know if the original Aramaic exists. But the fact that they were specifically asking for something that could indeed have been received makes me suspect if there is something more here than just symbolism. Because I think back to the days of the first century, in the Second Temple period, wherein which the Zealots and the Sicarii, they were all armed. They all had swords, daggers, and knives, and were very quick in using them. As we're going to read in a couple of lessons to come, Peter in the Garden of Gethsemane, Yeshu's right-hand man, he's got a sword. He certainly knows how to use it. Very zealot of him. But the foolish virgins don't have oil. Those who don't have faith in the imminent coming of Mashiach are not prepared for him. Is this lack of oil somehow a subtle hint to the fact that they were unarmed, they did not have weapons, and that possibly they were saying, oh, Mashiach is here, give us weapons to join his army? To which the wise answered and said, not so, lest there not be enough for us and you, but go ye rather to them that sell and buy for yourselves. That's kind of weird. You see, if this was speaking about religious merit, all right, you didn't have the merit to wait for the Messiah's coming, then what sense would it be to be told to go to the store and buy some? Can you really go to the store and buy merit? I don't think so. Can you go to the store and buy a weapon to help you in an armed insurrection? Oh yeah, that you could. So again, by looking at the subtleness of the specific nature of the text here, I'm really curious as to what Yeshu's original intent was. This is far more than just the subtle spiritual message of philosophical portent. No. There's something much more here. And then it says, and while they went to buy, the bridegroom came, and they that were ready went in with him to the marriage. And then the door was shut. Now what the heck is that all about? If it was spiritual and philosophical, then people who are repenting and acquiring merit, you don't shut the doors on them. You don't kick them out. You don't ban them to hell. So it doesn't make sense in that context. But if you're arming an army and you create cells and the cells are formed and they are clear and definitive, well, then you don't need others now, do you? And then when you would succeed and take over the government, who becomes your cabinet? Who becomes your inner circle? Obviously those who fought at your side. Yeshu made reference to his own people doing that forever. What about all the rest who want to be Johnny-come-latelys? They would properly be shut out. Hey, you weren't here in the height of battle, so what makes you think you're going to get the booty of battle? If Yeshu won, and he actually was able to overthrow the Romans, him and his 12 disciples, whoever survived, they would have become the new government. And for everyone else, oh well. So then it says, afterwards came along these other virgins saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. And he answered and said, verily I say to you, I know you not. Wait a second, what kind of answer is that? Why doesn't he answer them more directly? Hey, you didn't come on time. You weren't ready, so too bad. What is this I know you not stuff? That makes greater sense in the context of my understanding of this being an armed insurrection. Hey, we're here as the second wave to help you. Second wave? I don't think so. Where were you in the first wave when I needed you? And verse 13 states, watch therefore, for ye know not neither the day nor the hour wherein which the Son of Man cometh. Remember, Son of Man is that... Actually, remember, Son of Man, the Hebrew term is Ben Adam, which means the human being, which again is a reference to the supernatural Messiah, but yet who is still a human being of flesh and blood, kind of like David and Solomon. And that is how it was understood to be. So, in light of what the Gemara says, in light of how we understand the sudden appearance of Mashiach, all of this makes very much sense in a Jewish context. Now he gives another parable. For the kingdom of heaven is a man traveling into a far country, was called his servants and delivered unto them his goods. Again, the kingdom of heaven, again, a reference to the political government to be established here on earth by earthly means. So how or what? Who are the citizens of this kingdom, of this government? Well, Yeshu is now going to give us an idea of what he expects from people. So it says, unto one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1. To every man according to his several abilities, and straight away he took his journey. He went away, expecting the people who have been endowed with powers to do their work, to do their jobs, so that when he comes back, he finds them ready. Okay? How would I interpret that in a spiritual way? I can clearly understand that in a political way. I tell you, okay, I want you to go to towns A, B, C, and D, and I want you to gather for me 20, 30 guys from each town, get supplies ready, have arms made, right? Be ready in 3 months. Got it? Got it. All right, that makes sense. How do you prepare somebody and compare 5 talents, 2 talents, 1 spiritually? I want you to be righteous and good and moral? Well, okay. How do we then relate righteous, good, and moral, higher, lower value of such?
doesn't fit into the exact example. But continuing to the parable, he says that either received the 5 talents, he went, traded with them, and made another 5 talents. Likewise, he that received 2, he also gained another 2. They invested them and required profit. It wasn't that they just received and kept. They did something with what they had. He that received the 1 went and digged in the earth and hid his Lord's money. After a long time, the Lord of those servants came and he reckoned with them. So that he that received 5 talents came and brought another 5 talents, saying, Lord, you delivered to me 5 talents. Behold, I gained besides them 5 talents more. And his Lord said to them, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thou hast even been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Even now, into the joy of thy Lord. You know, I always found curious. If you give me 5 talents, $5, $500, whatever, and I invest it, who owns the profit made from the investment? You notice here, curiously, it did not say, the servant didn't say to his Lord, I'm returning to you 10 talents. He says, you gave me 5, and now look, I gave another 5. Never said he's giving him back 10, did he? You'll find the same thing with the next guy. His Lord says, very good, you did right, thumbs up. You proved yourself worthy in these things, now I'm going to make you a lord over other things. In a political context, this does make a lot of sense. If you were to send out leaders of an underground movement who are charged with, again, the building of that movement, and they are successful, well, those are the guys who you can trust. It makes sense within this context. So he says to the guy with 2 talents, and he said, Lord, you delivered to me 2 talents. Behold, I've gained 2 other talents beside them. Again, he never said that he's got 4 talents for his Lord. Lord says to them, well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee rule over many things, even thou into the joy of the Lord. Same thing as he said to the first guy. You're expected to take the investment and work on it. Now, I can symbolize this. I can interpret this metaphorically, I think, and say, well, if you're given the words of Torah and you increase your learning and knowledge, well, maybe that's what Yeshu said. It doesn't make sense, because that's not the kind of thing that Yeshu talks about. He doesn't talk about learning Torah. Yeshu doesn't talk about the type of Torah and mitzvot observant like the rabbis do. So to apply this in those contexts doesn't seem to fit. But again, to apply within the political insurrection context does seem to fit. Moving right along. Somebody here in text is saying about the American Revolution, how the individuals there, you know, invested and then worked together and became what we call the Founding Fathers. Reminds me of Benjamin Franklin's wise words. If you remember, Benjamin Franklin spoke to the people signing the Declaration of Independence, and he said, there you have it, guys. Either we will now hang together, or most certainly we will hang apart. I could see Yeshu saying those same kind of words to his followers. Alrighty, guys, we're in it now. So, we're in for it for the long haul, or not. That makes sense to Yeshu. That makes sense, in my eyes, how Yeshu is. So now, in that light, actually, it's turned to the third guy. He went to the guy who received 1 talent, and he said, Lord, I knew that you are a hard man. You reap where you have not sown, and gathered where you have not strawed. And I was afraid, and I went and hid the talent in the earth. Lo, there thou hast that is thine. He got back what he gave him. Now think about it. Did he really take the 5 extra talents from the first guy? Did he take the 2 extra talents from the second guy? It doesn't say that. I can make the argument that maybe those two kept that extra money of their own. And if that's the case, then the Lord didn't receive any extra. Why then would he be so ticked off at the guy who only returns him that which he gave him in the first place, if with the other two guys, it's the same thing? His Lord answered and said to him, "You wicked and slothful servant, you knew that I reap where I sowed not and gather where I have not strawed. Thou oughtest therefore put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I should have received mine own with interest." Does that imply that the others gave him the 2 and the 5 as interest? Doesn't say that though. "Take therefore the talent from him, give it to them which had 10 talents. He had 10 talents? He kept it? Really? Yes, I understand this now. You see, when we talk about the context of merit and observance, we're told that we have to build upon that which we have. In Yeshu's context historically, I'll bet you he was talking about his interpretation of Torah and mitzvot were specifically applied to military, political involvement. There are some rabbis who are like that to this very day, in all due respect. One recently who ended up not too differently from Yeshu. So ultimately, if and when you have somebody who you're charging with the important job of getting the insurrection all started up and moving, and it goes, "Well, I know you taught me and I know you charged me, but I was afraid of failure, so I kept my big mouth shut." Well, you can imagine Yeshu would have thought of such a guy. If this was spoken about an actual historical person, let's say there were 3 guys there, right? Peter, James, and Frank. Peter's the one who received the 5 talents and was blessed. James received the 2 talents and was blessed. And Frank? Well, you don't read about Frank as one of the 12 apostles now, do you? Maybe because Frank was this one guy, and Yeshu told the other guys to go out with Peter's sword and take care of him, or something similar. So I understand, within the context of these parables here, that, let me read this. "For ultimately, everyone that hath shall be given, and he that have abundance, but from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. And cast ye the unprofitable servant into the outer darkness, there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Is that outer darkness a place outside the kingdom of heaven? I've heard certain Christians interpret it like that. But their version of a kingdom of heaven is heaven above, in the sky. Here, it would be Yeshu's interpretation that he's going to put some guy in harem, kick him out of the Jewish people. He's going to say, "Now that my kingdom has come and I have taken over, if you are not one of my kind of Jews, then out you go." That makes sense within the greater context of Yeshu. Now, here's a very interesting teaching, the end of chapter 25, which actually speaks about Yeshu's understanding of judgment in the time of the coming of Mashiach. Now, in my opinion, this is very important, because the fundamental Christian message is that you need the faith in the blood of Yeshu for salvation in order to enter heaven and to avoid an eternity in hell. If you believe it, you got it. If you don't, well, go to hell. Well, Yeshu does not teach this fundamental Christian message. Yeshu is actually teaching a Jewish message here. Let me read it first, and then let's understand it. Chapter 25, starting with 31. "When the Son of Man," again, the title for the miraculous super Messiah, "he comes in his glory, and all the holy angels with him," based upon Zechariah, "then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory," meaning here on earth, establishing the earthly kingdom. "And before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. One second here. Now, this is obviously political. This is not speaking of heaven, but clearly on the earth, kind of like what we would read in the book of Zechariah, or even Isaiah, the prophecy of the judgment of the nations of the world. Again, in Talmudic and post-Talmudic Midrash, these teachings proliferate. And he states, he shall set the sheep on his right hand and the goats on the left. Essentially, the sheep are the good guys, the goats are the bad guys. And then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Now that is a curious language. Didn't we just say he's gathering all the nations? And he refers to the members of the nations. I don't mean to be derogatory, but let's put it into the original Hebrew term. He's talking to the goyim. He's not talking to Jews. He is talking to Gentiles. Inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Who is he talking to? Answer, Gentiles. What Gentiles have been prepared from the beginning of the foundations of the world to inherit the kingdom? The answer is the righteous of the nations. The Hasidei Umot HaOlam. We call them the Noahites. You remember the entire purpose of giving of the Torah was to be a light to the nations. And as Malachi says, from the rising of the sun to the going down thereof, great is God's name among the nations. For even when a person was a devoted idolater, if in his heart he believed he was showing devotion to the Creator, God accepted and counted that as a blessing. And how many people are like that in the world today? All different religions, all different walks of life, races, creeds, colors, whatever. I want to believe billions. At least I pray. At least hundreds of millions, if not millions. Lots of people. There are a lot of good people out there. These are called the sheep. And it is said that the kingdom, the messianic time, has been prepared for them, made for them since the foundation of the world. In other words, they're the ones who, from the beginning, this is what it's all about. Now, they ask and say to him something very simple. Let me go back here. The messianic character then says to them, when I was hungry, you gave me food. When I was thirsty, you gave me drink. And when I was a stranger, you took me in. When I was naked, you clothed me. When I was sick, you visited me. These are all the performance of the mitzvot, the commandments of the Torah, of how to treat one's neighbor. When I was in prison, you came and visited me. And then shall the righteous answer him. Here we are, the righteous of the nations. They're going to turn and say, in all due respect, when we saw thee hungered, when did we feed and hunger in you? When did we ever see you? Right? When you were ever a stranger? When did we ever take you in? When were you ever naked? When did we ever clothe you? When were you ever sick that we came? Or were you ever in prison? In all due respect, O King, it's not like we've ever met before. I don't really think that we gave you anything to eat or drink or clothe you or anything else. And, we appreciate your blessings, but being that we're honest, righteous folk, it's not like we've never really did this for you. To which the king then answers and says, verily I say to you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, you have done it unto me. Now here is the million-dollar question. Who are we talking? Who said these words? The Son of Man, the King, the Messiah. Who is he? Oh, that's right. He's the King of the Jews.
He's the Messiah of Israel.
And he is saying to the righteous of the nations who are not Jews or Israel, that you are blessed. Why? Because whenever you took care of any of my brethren, it's as if you did it for me. You see, here's where Isaiah 53 fits in. Big argument, Jews and Christians. Does Isaiah 53, the prophecy of the suffering servant, refer to the Messiah or to the entire nation of Israel? And I cannot understand for the likes of me why people think that this is an argument. The Messiah is a citizen of the nation of Israel, and therefore whatever applies to the nation applies to him. He's the king and leader of the nation. So therefore, whatever happens to the king and the leader applies to the people. It's really one and the same as far as I'm concerned. As such, whatever is the relationship between the king and the people, it's one and the same. So when the nations of the world show kindness to the brethren of the king, to the Jewish people, it is as if they're showing it to the Mashiach, to God himself. And this, therefore, is the foundation of judgment. The great judgment in the time to come is that the nations will be judged on the crimes of anti-Semitism. That ultimately everyone is going to be asked, were you a righteous and decent human being? How did you treat God's people? How did you treat those who were destined to be, chosen to be, a light to the nations? Now remember, Israel are his 12 tribes, not just the tribe of Judah known as Jews today, but even the lost tribes. You will be held accountable for how you treated them. There are many legends today, been around for hundreds of years. Book written in the 1700s by an author named James Adair. How the nation of the Cherokee here in Native America are a lost tribe. And they were subject to horrible persecution and suffering here in this land, similar to the horrible suffering and persecution that Jews of Judah suffered in many lands. The Cherokee were thought to be a lost tribe. And they certainly were treated like one, that's for sure. Those who did that to the Cherokee, if indeed the Cherokee are native Israelites, those who did that to them will be subject to this judgment. How did you treat them? You want to know something else interesting? Oh, it's going to open up a can of worms. Go and do your history of the African slave market, where in which many black Africans were, of you know, their nations conquered and enslaved. Many of the nations conquered and enslaved were the Jewish nations, the Ethiopians. Many of the black slaves sold into the slave markets brought to the New World were the Jewish Africans, the Jewish black Africans, which means that many of the black Africans here in Israel, here in the United States today, might have been of Israelite stock. Look what they suffered. Very similar to Israel. There will be judgment for how they were treated as well. And we can go on and on down the list. And this is why God planted 12 tribes all throughout the world, to see how people will treat them. And the judgment of the nations and every individual will be upon our humanity and how we treat one another. That is the big judgment. Notice here that Yeshua is not judging anybody based upon a theological concept or a doctrine or a dogma. He didn't say, well, you didn't believe, you didn't have faith, you weren't washed in the blood of the Lamb. Absent, missing, gone, not there in the first place. Yeshua is teaching a classical and traditional Jewish message here, the one which is very much a reality to this day. Look to the world.
look to times of conflict in modern day state of Israel. And look, don't look to the anti-Semitic people who hate Jews in Israel, but look to those who claim that they are not, and how apathetic they are to the suffering of modern day Israelis, and to the apathy that they might take to the Israelite positions. Ask if there will be judgment on that. Another interesting thing, many of these so-called Palestinians who so cling to the land, it's very possible that they are also of the lost bloodline of Israel. If that explains why they're so determined to stay in the land, maybe they are also lost Jews. Of course, that probably would give each one of them a heart attack and put them in the grave, but might be a truth one way or another. Yeshu continues. He says, then they shall also say to those on the left hand, depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. You only find that as a reference in Enochian literature. It's the only place that mentions a fire prepared for the devil and his angels. So, everybody else of the nations is condemned because of their inhumanity towards their fellow man, because their inhumanity towards Israel. All 12 tribes, not just one. For when I was hungry, you gave me not food. When I was thirsty, you didn't give me drink. When I was a stranger, you didn't take me in. Naked, you didn't clothe me. Sick, and you didn't come and visit me. When I was in prison, you didn't come and visit me. Then they should answer, hey, when did we ever see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger, naked, sick, blah, blah, blah? And again he answered them, verily I say to you, inasmuch as ye did it not to one of the least of these, ye did it not to me. And these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal. Now, these concepts of eternal punishment and eternal life, they're still foreign to Judaism at the time of Yeshu's talking. So I question whether or not Yeshu actually spoke of any kind of eternal anything. We don't have that concept developed then. We don't have it now. You will find some midrashic, non-literal references, maybe in Enochian literature, to the punishment of the watchers, the fallen angels, and the like. But not necessarily about the souls of men. Again, you find this more in the midrashic literature, meaning to be taken symbolically, but no scriptural evidence about that whatsoever. I don't necessarily think this is an important point, because midrash stories are stories, and so be it as they are. But I conclude here with an understanding of how Yeshu himself is teaching how judgment will come about. Again, it has nothing to do with theology, nothing to do with dogma or doctrine, but righteous behavior. You find this same Jewish teaching echoed in the teachings of Yeshu's blood brother, James, when he speaks of faith, and he says, faith without works is dead. Why? Because even the Talmud itself acknowledges that the entire Torah is summed up into one commandment, the wise words spoken by the prophet Habakkuk, the righteous live by their faith. But your faith is not a statement of theological beliefs. The faith is the underlying attitude which motivates your behavior. In Yeshu's context, your faith was meant to be that faith in overthrowing Rome. In a modern context, our faith has to be the righteousness of our humanity. And indeed, Yeshu echoes the same classical Jewish teachings. Judgment comes for the lack of righteousness. No theological dogma test required. And on that note, we'll conclude here, concluding chapter 25.
We could have gone for a couple of minutes more and gone into 26, but being that we're getting now into the death and the resurrection subject, we'll start that anew with next class, because we discuss now this whole concept of, in quote, the passion. Boy, oh boy, we have a quagmire of problems that we're going to have to get into and unravel. I don't know what. It's a very involved and interesting teaching. With the grace of God, we'll get into in our next class. So again, thank you all for joining me. I'm your host, Ariel Bar Tzedok. Come see me online at koshertorah.com. See you all in our next class. God bless. Good night. Shalom.